If you are among the more than 4,000 drivers who will hit a deer today, or your kid's soccer field is an unplayable mess of goose droppings, or a coyote has snatched your cat, or beavers have flooded your backyard, or wild turkeys have attacked your mailman, you may wonder why. As award-winning journalist and reporter Jim Sterba explains, it is very likely that more people live in closer proximity to more wild animals and birds in the eastern United States today than anywhere on the planet at any time in history. He writes about it in his new book, Nature Wars, the incredible story of how wildlife comebacks turned backyards into battlegrounds. The book is published by Crown. It's a great pleasure to welcome Jim Sterba to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Joe, it's great to be here.
What brought you down this path, this subject of these nature wars?
I started writing stories for the Wall Street Journal maybe 25 years ago as a result of going back to my boyhood home on a farm country in Michigan. And I noticed all these changes in the land and changes in the wildlife distributions. The pheasants we used to hunt were all gone. The deer had moved down south into new forests that had taken over old croplands. Wild turkeys were beginning to come back in the late 80s and 90s, and I just expanded from there. I was talking to Gordon Batchelor up at DEC. Many years ago, and I said, Gordon, why are the beavers coming back to this area? He said, we brought them back, and we brought back their habitat. And then he said, if you get in a plane and you fly from downtown Albany to downtown Boston, you'll fly over in the daytime almost nothing but trees. If you fly over the same territory at night from downtown to downtown, you'll see it's full of lights, meaning that all of these people are living out there in the sprawl with increasing numbers of wildlife.
And that is striking, because this has happened really somewhat slowly over time, right?
Yeah, I mean, the conservation movement kicked in the end of the 19th century after 300 years of devastation of wildlife. Commercial hunters killed everything that they could sell for meat, hides, fur, feathers, and so they turned that around. But it took decades and decades to bring a lot of these creatures back. Deer was pretty easy in Pennsylvania. They were foresters were complaining about too many deer in the 1920s. But in other places, even in the 60s, it was rare that you saw a deer or a Canada goose or anything like that. And then, I mean, what happened was that by the year 2000, according to the census, an absolute majority of Americans live not in cities or on working farms, but in this vast sprawl in between. And that sprawl used to be full of small family farms. Now it's full of people who have who live out in the country, a lot of them don't hunt. They don't manage these landscape, and they lure creatures in with food and so on, and they create a mess. I mean, it's a mess of riches, really.
And that mess of riches, the question, of course, is what do we do about it? So the animals themselves, what draws them to these places?
Well, our habitat's better than theirs in many cases. I mean, we offer them plenty of food. We offer them hiding places. We offer them water. We offer them places that they can give birth. And best of all, we offer them predator protection. We've taken ourselves out of the predation business, even though in the case of deer, man has probably been the top predator of them for the 11,000 years since the last ice age. But in recent decades, we've pretty much gotten out of that, especially in the sprawl, where people have passed all sorts of laws that restrict firearms and that in turn restricts hunting. In Massachusetts, for example, two laws alone about the discharge of firearms within 150 feet of a hard surface road or 500 feet of an occupied dwelling, and many states have these laws. Those two laws alone put 60% of the state of Massachusetts off limits to hunting with firearms.
When you think about where the animals are, I live in a very rural county. It is, quote unquote, out in the middle of nowhere. But in my drive daily, I can see acres, hundreds and hundreds of acres of farmland where there at any given time are 20, 30, 40, 50 deer. You can count hundreds on a simple 45-minute ride home. This seems to be somewhat, even to me who's been doing this drive for 15 plus years, unprecedented.
Yeah, I think deer populations started to explode in the late 70s, 80s, and 90s. The populations doubled and tripled in many areas. In a normal peopleless landscape, the biologists tell me that maybe 10 to 15 deer is a good number. More than 20, and they're starting to damage the ecosystem. But in places, not just in the country, but in the sprawl, you can have 60, 80, 100 deer per square mile. And they're doing a lot of ecosystem damage to forests, for example, forest understories, where they eat out the plants that for example, understory birds depend on, and small mammals as well. And insects that these creatures eat. So in that case, we're just not doing a good job of managing our whitetail herd. And one of the reasons is because, as I just said, other reasons are that hunters had been declining for decades. There's been a recent spike in the last 5 years, but they're just growing and growing.
I mean, I always sort of grew up with the idea, which was, okay, they were here first, though, but that's not necessarily the case. Their relatives may have been here, but the huge numbers were not here.
Yeah, that's right. They were just decimated by the end of the 19th century. Something like maybe 25 million deer that were here at the time of Columbus had been reduced to less than 500,000 by 1900, and it's taken all those decades for them to get back up to now what is 25, some say 50 million whitetails. And of course, they're living amongst us, and there are out there in the sprawl in the eastern forest something like 210 million people. So we're all sort of crowded together, and we don't quite know what to do.
So how much of it is our fault? How much of it is their fault?
Well, I think that it's a combination. We have to relearn from our mistakes how to be better managers of the ecosystems in which we live for the benefit of the plants, the animals, and the people. Kids' soccer fields were built for kids to play soccer on, not to be occupied by hundreds or thousands of Canada geese. The same way with deer and the same way with bears. I mean, if you put out food and bears start associating the smell of humans with food, they're going to keep coming back around, and pretty soon they're going to try getting into your back porch and getting at the dog food, say, instead of just your garbage cans, or licking the grease off your grill out on the back porch. And then pretty soon somebody's going to call 911, and they're going to send the game people out to dart the bear and take it 100 miles somewhere else. But the bear's still got this memory, and he does it two or three times, and the bear gets killed because there's a two strikes or three strikes in your out policy with potentially dangerous bears. And, of course, it's not the bear's fault. It's the people's fault who tend to anthropomorphize these creatures and think of them as pets or little people. And that's the result of all sorts of movies and TV shows and so on, and in which bears are portrayed as cute little people.
There's a section in the book in which you write about a vote that took place in 1996 in Massachusetts, where voters looked to ban this body gripping and killing trap called the conibear, saying that it was cruel. You make the point in the book that in 1961, the American Humane Association awarded it a certificate of merit for humaneness. In 1970, Queen Elizabeth personally thanked its inventor. It's a fascinating history, but I guess it perfectly illustrates our changing thoughts and feelings about our relationship to nature and the outside world.
In the case of the Conner Bear, I think Massachusetts voters were voting to ban these traps because they thought they were saving the beavers' lives by doing it, and that anything that killed beavers was cruel and inhumane. Well, the Conner Bear, which is approved by the European Union for use, also did that. But the substitutes were live catch traps. But because it's illegal in Massachusetts and many other states to relocate wildlife because they may spread disease or they may occupy a space already occupied, the beavers end up just as dead. But I don't think Massachusetts voters really focused on that, and it certainly wasn't brought up during the campaign for this initiative.
And there was so much, in remembering this debate, there was so much about the suffering of the animals, of the gripping of the animal, and the animal traveling with the trap intact, and then suffering and dying. And I mean, Jim, it was rather, it's a horrible thing to picture of any creature suffering like that.
Well, that's right. But the Conner Bear studies done by some Canadian researchers found that the killing time for a Conner Bear, what it does is it sort of snaps onto the back of the neck of a beaver or other creatures, and it kind of breaks their neck and spinal cord, and it kills them within what they call a time frame that minimizes their suffering.
So what can we do where we can all get along, where we don't have to kill the creatures, but we can cohabitate and ultimately reduce these numbers to more manageable levels?
That's a good question. We don't like to kill stuff, but I have a friend who's a deer consultant for deer problems in Pennsylvania, and he often recommends human-directed mortality, which is a polite way of saying the same thing. I think that when you consider that man was the biggest deer predator, and we still kill... Hunters kill about 6 million a year. We now kill 1 to 2 million with our cars. Say another 6 million die of disease or starvation or something else. That's still 14 million, and it's not enough to control, let alone lower, the number of white-tailed deer out there. And so I don't know if we're all going to be able to get along. I think that we as a keystone species have an obligation to manage our environment for the health of all these creatures. And when one gets out of hand, we have an obligation to do something about it.
So basically, this is the circle of life we hear so much about, but we have taken out the one element that we're feeding on, or that we are taking care of a certain species to allow that circle to complete its course.
I think what's happened is we've divided up. We've become species partisans, as we say in the book. Some people want to save deer. There was a lawsuit filed in Poughkeepsie to stop Vassar from culling the deer herd in its 500-acre reserve. Some people want to save deer. Some people want to save geese. Some people want to save beavers. And sometimes we're doing that at the expense of other creatures or ourselves or our kids. And yet we think nothing of... I mean, we tell ghoulish jokes about hitting things with our cars as if that was just a price of transportation.
It's a fascinating story, and you can read about it in the book, Nature Wars, the incredible story of how wildlife comebacks turned backyards into battlegrounds. The book is published by Crown. Jim Sturba will be at Oblong Books in Rhinebeck on Sunday. That's the 13th of January, Sunday at 4 o'clock, talking about and signing the book. And again, it is Sunday at 4, January 13th, and you can find out more information at oblongbooks.com. The name of the book, Nature Wars. Jim Sturba, great pleasure. Thank you very much for spending time with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Nature Wars. It's published by Crown. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.